And good morning. Welcome to Jaws of Justice Radio on 90.1 FM, KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio. It's Monday morning. My name is Beth Pike, and we're going to have to apologize. We will not be able to bring you our talk with Christy Childs of Veronica's Voices this morning because of some illness, but we'll reschedule that and have her back as soon as she is better. Instead, today, we are going to replay the last interview that Jeff Humfeld did with Richard Tripp. And Richard was the director of and founder of Care of Poor People. Then, in the second half of the show, our host Keith Brown Ill will be talking with Jamala Rogers, and they'll be talking about human rights and activists, because Jamala is an activist for that, and she's also the author of Ferguson in America, Roots and Rebellion. So they'll be talking about that during her presentation, and also a book signing that she has coming up later tonight here in Kansas City. You'll also want to stay tuned for the calendar of events in the middle of the show and our 420 drug war news at the end of the show. But now the interview with Richard.
This past Saturday would have been the annual Care of Poor People Spring Break, an event that provided clothing, bedding, toiletries, a good hot meal, and even musical entertainment for the poor and homeless of our community for around 30 years. Unfortunately, Spring Break did not happen for these folks. The founder and director of Care of Poor People, Richard Tripp, passed away from lung cancer at the beginning of the month, and his failing health had already prevented him from holding his winter survival event at Thanksgiving last year. Today, we are going to replay the last interview Richard did for Jaws of Justice Radio. And while it is a bittersweet conversation, it was one of hope and a look into a future that can still happen even in Richard's absence. I hope you will listen and take with you Richard's message. That is, you, yes, you, can make the difference in the life of someone in need. Welcome, and this is Jeff Humfeld, and I am here with Richard Tripp. He is the director of and founder of Care of Poor People here in Kansas City. Richard's been doing a COP for, what, over 35 years?
Yeah, roughly.
Okay. Well, I want to read something that I got off of your website, and it's going to lead into a little story that I want you to tell us. I had been under that bridge for a few weeks, and it was really starting to get cold. I knew I had to figure out a way to survive, so I went to one of the shelters and became a staff member at that particular shelter. The only reason I did it was because I knew I wouldn't get kicked out at 6 in the morning when the shelter closed if I was a staff member. Well, I had been there only a couple of weeks. One of my duties was to put away some of the donated food that was brought in to feed the poor. Anyway, I'm putting away these sandwiches that this gentleman and his little 5-year-old son had brought us. And Richard, I'm going to let you continue the story from there.
Okay. The little boy gave me a brown paper sack. Now, thinking it was candy or gum or whatever, I just stuck it in my pocket, you know. Well, I continued to put the sandwiches away. I thanked the kid, you know, like you do. And I was sitting there putting the sandwich away, and Stuart Whitney, which was the founder, director of Restart, walked up to me and he said, "Mr. Tripp, we got 100 ministerial students from St. Paul School of Theology coming down, and somebody's got to tell them about this place." And since Dog got sick — Dog was the leader of the group then, that's a nickname we gave him — he said, "Guess what? You're going to get to speak to him." Well, understand, Jeff, I had never spoke to anybody about anything, let alone the homeless, you know. And it was about an hour later when they got there, and I got up on that little pedestal in the basement of Grand Avenue Temple, and I looked out at all these ministers, and I just froze. My voice froze. I froze, literally. I mean, but I remembered that sack in my pocket, and I pulled that sack out. When I did, I started getting tears in my eyes, and I know I must have looked funny to them guys, because I had great big old tears coming because it touched me so much how God had touched me then. Because what was in that sack was a little Jewish boy's piggy bank. Now that touched me to the core, and I thought to myself, here I am trying to take care of me, but yet this little baby boy gives everything he's got for the homeless. How much more should I personally do than what I've done? When do you stop worrying about yourself and worrying about others? Well, for me, that was the day, because that's when the ideas jumped in and COPS started. And 35 years ago, I've been doing it ever since, and I don't regret a bit of it.
Well, I want to ask you, because there's a number of different things that COP has done over the years. You know, a lot of people know about the events after Thanksgiving and right at Easter time and all, but there's other things that COP has done also and been involved in. And why don't you tell us a few of those things?
Well, you know, I'd like to take and tell everybody, hey, I'm this great guy, I did all this stuff, but you got to understand one thing. I motivated people. It was the community that actually did the work. It's the community that can make change in our area. Yeah, it takes somebody like me to give them a conscience sometime, but it's the actual community that does it. You know, there has been things that have tried to pass laws to keep people from feeding the homeless, even in their own yard. And luckily enough, God's gave me the power to counteract that. You know, I looked at the mirror here, oh, what was it, 6 months ago, when they tried to pass that law. And I looked at him and I said, you're not going to pass that law in my city. Well, I'm kind of particular. This is my city. This is my community. Now, how do I expect somebody else to get up and fight if I won't get up and fight myself? So I looked at him and I said, Mr. Mayor, you're not going to pass that law. And he looked at me like, you know, who in the do you think you are? Well, a half hour later, they had the deal. You was there. And it got through out. You know, I'd like to say I did it, but you got to understand, I brought members of the community, other little groups that nobody ever hears from. And we picketed down there. You know, it's like when I started COP. Now, one of the things that I did, I was the first person in Kansas City to ever picket a shelter. And I did it for the right reasons. But I put my life on the line doing that, believe it or not. Because there was people back then, if you mess with people's money, you get in trouble. And people don't realize it. The majority of people don't realize that homelessness is big business. Multi-millions of dollars thrown into it every year. It don't seem to change. But the money gets thrown into it, and it evaporates, and a lot of it don't go to where it's supposed to go. We all know this. But people never think about, you know, the business of homelessness.
Well, I would expect that if you had picketed a shelter, that you were probably persona non grata at just about every other shelter in town at that,
yeah, I was
from that
ball.
Point on, because they didn't want you coming around and picketing them because of something you'd seen inside their shelter or things where you thought were going wrong. So I can understand when you say that, you know, that was something that could have put your own existence in some peril, because you, it got cold, there wouldn't be a place for you to go.
Well, people don't.
I mean, that's part of it.
People ask, they ask me all the time, well, why did you start COP? Why? People don't realize how much personal hurt I had to go through in order to make me so macho, shall we say, to where I didn't want to see other people being hurt like I'd been hurt. What most people don't know, when I was younger in my life, my kids was ripped out by the from my wife. They was taken from my wife by DFS.
Yeah. Division of Family Services.
I tried for a long time. It ruined me. Because when they take your babies, man, and you know you can't get them back, and you try everything. And I mean, I tried it. I got married 3 times just so I had another woman take care of the kids. Man, it still didn't work. After so much hurt from that, and, you know, people say men don't cry. Boy, are they wrong. Because I did my share. But there came a time in my life when I figured that that was it. I wasn't going to get them back, no matter what I did. And I mean, I tried everything. And I decided right then that, okay, God, I can't get mine back. But I'll do everything I can in my power to make sure they can't pull this on somebody else. And that's really been my whole way of doing things. Is I got enough hurt myself. I didn't want to see other people going, you know, and people call welfare on a woman or a guy and not realize how much these people really love. There's too many. It ends up being a money thing.
Well, it is for the agencies and for the government agencies also. You know, the private agencies that deal in these things. Our tax dollars go a long way into areas that we think they don't, or we don't think they shouldn't. In a lot of ways, you know, there's good reason. There's children that do need
right,
protection.
Right, there are.
There are plenty of them that need protection. But we also have systems that
once
when
they get in the system,
yeah.
You can almost not get them out of the system.
Yeah.
No matter what you do. Look, I love my babies more than anything in this world. And today, I've got a daughter and a son that won't even speak to me because of the stuff that welfare put in their heads back then. And if there's anything that hurts more than anything else because I did things wrong. You know, I'm human. We are human. But when you go to rip somebody's babies off, you got to use some common sense. My kids wasn't hurt back then. They tried all kinds of stuff to make me out this terrible person. They couldn't prove none of it because it was all bull. But that's actually what got cops started. I figured maybe I could save somebody else the pain. And still, you know, it's always been about survival, about keeping people alive in wintertime. Until lately, now my focus, you know, you see all these people in the corners with the signs, we'll work for food and all this stuff. Why not change that? This is our community. And, you know, we got a lot of teenagers and a lot of college students that's journalists. In other cities, they've made papers. One problem being with the paper is the majority of them write it for the homeless. I want to start a paper that's not wrote for the homeless. It's wrote for the public. And it don't deal with just homelessness.
All right. We're going to get to the newspaper here in a minute. There's a couple other things that I'd really like to get at. One of them is, by your own admission, you're like a ninth grade dropout. So, you know, education is not real strong on one of your strong suits here. But you've written books. You've written 2 books.
Let me explain this to people, and I want everybody to really listen to this. God gave us all the greatest computer in the world. It's sitting on our shoulders. All we got to do is use it. I got 4 words I live by, and I think everybody should think about these 4 words. Never fear, never quit. Because I tell you something, that millionaire out there, he puts his pants on just like you do. You can get out of anything. All you got to do is not fear, don't quit. If you want something, go after it. Keep going after it. Don't give up.
Well, tell us, the first book that you wrote was Please Underestimate Me, I believe.
The second book.
That was the second one? What was the first one again? The
first one was It's Hip to Help the Homeless.
Okay, that's right. I got them both on the bookshelf, and I've read them, but it's been a while.
You know what I'm proud of? Both books are in the library in Jerusalem, in the Jewish library, in the temple. And that's one of my proudest things.
All right. You've also, although your voice is trying to betray you today, you've been a motivational speaker, so to say, for a long time, dealing with the issues of homelessness, of course. But you've also been on stage with some pretty high-powered people over the years.
You know, it's amazing what God will put you through if you got a mission. And I had a mission. And I've been on with Gandhi and Rudy and Tony Robbins and Mark Victor Hansen, Jack Canfield, you name it. If it's a motivational speaker, I've probably been on stage with them. They all know me. The difference is I had a purpose, and it wasn't to make money. Most of them make money. And I never figured out why I never went after the money. I don't know. Maybe if you're poor, you got a poor attitude. I don't know. But, yeah, it, you know, God put me there. It started by getting Mark Victor Hansen, the chicken soup guy, in my cab here in Kansas City, taking him to the airport. Now, you figure I got 40 minutes to the airport from downtown. I'm doing 70 miles an hour. He's got to listen to me. He can't go nowhere. So, you know, that's the con artist in me. I know how to do it. And luckily, by the time I got him to the airport, I had done indoctrinating, and they helped me with COP, and they helped me with one of our events, which was the neatest thing in the world. But the really neat thing is most people don't know I used to be an alcoholic. And the day I picked him up, I had just got out of Truman Medical Center. I spent 38 days in a coma at Truman. And I got out, and I was walking around on a walker. And I got my cab back, and I put the walker in, and I grabbed a hold and went around the car to the door and got in. And Mark Victor Hansen was my first trip that day. Now, that had to be a God thing. That wasn't a trip thing. That was a God thing. And for those that don't believe he exists, believe me, I know he exists. All this stuff I've done, I could have not conceived. It had to be somebody up above doing it.
All right. I want to remind everybody you are listening to Jaws of Justice Radio here on KKFI. And my name is Jeff Humfeld, and with me is Richard Tripp. He is the director of and founder of Care of Poor People here in Kansas City. Richard, let's get to the new project, the newspaper, and what your vision is. I know we've talked about this a number of times, and you've got this 10-10-10 idea. And go ahead and tell people what it is and what you need.
Okay. First, I'll tell everybody, unfortunately, 2 weeks ago, I found out I have terminal cancer. And it's messing with my voice right now and everything else. It's pretty bad. They say I ain't got long. But, you know, 30 years ago, laying in a coma, they said I didn't have long then either. So, you know, I'm playing a bet. But here's the thing. I've always tried to make a difference. And on my way out, I want to make the biggest difference I've ever made. I can't do it by myself, I don't think. I'm not sure I have enough time left. But if I don't have time, I have a community here, a community of young people that get ideas. And I've got this idea. I'm so tired of seeing these people on the corners waving a sign, we'll work for food. Let's give them a way to survive. How do we do that? Other cities have had newspapers. They have newspapers. New Orleans especially. They sell a million papers a week. One of the hard parts is I'm just a ninth grade dropout. How'd I pull it off? Well, I pull it off by going to the colleges and the schools, talking, getting the elite kids that want to make a difference in our community and getting them involved. Now, a lot of problems with homeless newspapers is exactly that. People write them for the homeless. I don't want to write a paper for the homeless. I want the paper to be about poverty in our community, in the nation, in the world. Anything to do with poverty will have stories in this paper. I call it the 10-10-10 mag. What it will be is 10 local stories, 10 mixed national and international stories, and then them sell it, make people keep coming back. We'll have 10 motivational stories, like your chicken soup books. That way, people will want to come back and buy the paper. The homeless will make $2 off the paper. We'll sell it to them for 60 cents for costs of making the paper and everything. But this will be a chance for the community to shine. It will be a chance for the community to talk about the stories. Because believe me, if you get the community talking, we can come up with ways to change things. Like the community radio station does. Jaws of Justice. You come up with different stories about different aspects of what's wrong. Well, I want this paper to do the same thing. But if I can't pull it off, if I haven't got the time, there's got to be somebody listening today that will take on the project. Because, you know, I don't care if my name's on there or not. I never did. What I care about is making a difference in our community. And this is a chance for Kansas City to really make a difference.
So, in other words, you're going to need some help to make this happen.
Oh, definitely.
And how would people get a hold of you? How would someone that's listening to this today and saying, you know, yeah, I think I can make a difference here. I can help. How would they get a hold of you? And
they can call me. Area code 816-721-3291. Again, area code 816-721-3291. Or they can go to our website and get a hold of us there at www.coppinc.com. That's coppinc.com. Again, www.coppinc.com. Or they can go to the Care of Poor People's Facebook page, which they can pretty well get a hold of us there, too. That's the Care of Poor People's Facebook page.
Okay. We're looking at COP, whose organization that's been on the books here and been doing good things for years, over 30 years, 35 years maybe here or so. If you're not going to be around much longer, or which I... Knowing you, we'll be talking about this another 10 years, but do you have someone in line to maybe continue the work of COP itself? I mean,
we're trying to bring in new blood. It takes new blood. One of the things that I found out over the years is people get tired. A lot of our staff have just got old and dying off. We need young blood. I need people that really want to make a difference to come in, get involved. We need new board members. I need people to be motivated to make a difference here in our community. That's what COP's always done. We've motivated people. Everybody says, like I said, that I'm this nice guy. I do all this stuff. It's not me. I motivate other people into doing it. And when I'm gone, which could be any time, there's going to be somebody come along that keeps it up. You know, I'm surprised. I got kids now that are grown people that helped me back when I started that are coming in helping us. So, you know, I got a little bit of a legacy. And hopefully, you know, my dream about the paper will happen. There's got to be some organization out here, if I can't do it, that will do it.
Okay, why don't you, very quickly here, because we're out of time, give them the website again.
Okay, it's www.coppinc.com, which is coppinc.com, or our Facebook page, Care of Poor People's Facebook page.
Well, Richard, it's been a real pleasure to speak to you today, and my friend. We hopefully will be talking, like I said, in another 10 years. We'll still be talking to you, but we'll see.
Thank you, brother.
Now, the calendar for March 28, 2016. The KC Freedom Project and other supporters will rally in front of the Jackson County Courthouse, 415 East 12th Street, KCMO, Thursday, March 31st at 10 a.m. They are demanding that the Jackson County Prosecutor, Gene Peters Baker, form a conviction integrity unit, and that the case of Keith Carnes and other wrongfully convicted citizens be investigated. KC Freedom Project feels we cannot allow the wrongfully convicted to languish in prison for crimes they did not commit while the real criminals are still on the street. For more information, contact Latara Smith at 816-456-9776. The Kansas City chapter of Empower Missouri's First Friday Forum will be Friday, April 1st, 11:30 a.m. to 1 p.m. at the Westport Flea Market, 817 Westport Road, KCMO. Empower Missouri works to inform and lobby the Missouri legislature on issues that benefit Missouri citizens. The KC Area Chapter of Parents of Murdered Children and Other Survivors of Homicide will hold their monthly meeting Friday, April 1st, 7:30 p.m. at Our Lady of Sorrows Church, 2552 Gillum Road, KCMO. POMC makes the difference through ongoing emotional support, education, prevention, advocacy, and providing assistance to all survivors of homicide victims while working to create a world free of murder. Mama on a Mission will hold their second annual fundraiser, Walk a Mile in My Shoes, Saturday, April 2nd at Central Park, 31st and Indiana, KCMO. Registration will be at 9 a.m. and the walk will begin at 10 a.m. For more information, call 816-499-1214 or online at www.mamaonamission.com. There will be a construction career fair Saturday, April 2nd at the Robert J. Mohart Center, 3200 Wayne Avenue, KCMO. Registration begins at 8:30 a.m. and the fair runs from 9 to 11:30 a.m. You must be 18 years of age or older to participate. There will be representatives from over 20 craft union apprenticeship programs available. A severe shortage of trained workers is expected in the Kansas City area in the coming months. Take this opportunity to get not just a job, but a career. For more information, contact Frida Jenkins at 816-471-2330. Extension 1290, or email fjenkins at feckc.org. My name is Jeff Humfeld, reminding you that these events and more can be found on the Jaws of Justice Radio Facebook page, as well as the Jaws of Justice Radio page on the KKFI website, kkfi.org. You are listening to 90.1 FM, KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio. Tune in next week when we spend an hour with prison poets from the Kansas State Penitentiary in Lansing. Up next is Keith Brown L. and his guest, Jamala Rogers.
Jamala Rogers is a native of Kansas City, Missouri, and has spent all of her adult life in St. Louis, Missouri. She was radicalized as a young teen and has devoted her life to working for a society free of injustice and all forms of exploitation. She is first and foremost a lover of children, believing that if we want healthy, caring, and productive adults, we must start with giving people what they need when they come into the world as babies. This means creating the structures and supports that develop young people to their fullest potential, regardless of race, color, religion, gender, or sexual orientation. Jamala is an organizer, educator, lecturer, and writer. She is author of The Best of the Way I See It, a 20-year compilation of her political writings, and her most recent book, Ferguson is America, Roots of Rebellion. She is the featured columnist in the award-winning St. Louis newspaper and serves on the educational boards of BlackCommentator.com and Black Scholar. She is the inspiration for the Jamala Rogers Young Visionary Award, a scholarship for young activists engaged in social justice work. She is the Austin Banner Fellow in the 2017 Activist in Residence at the University of Wisconsin-Madison and the current administrative head of OBS, the Organization of Black Struggle in St. Louis, Missouri.
Good morning and welcome to Jaws of Justice Radio. My name is Keith Brownhill, and we are privileged to have Ms. Jamala Rogers on our broadcast this morning. Good morning, Jamala, and welcome to the show.
Good morning, and thank you for having me. How you doing these days?
Oh, I'm doing fairly well. How about yourself?
I'm doing good.
Okay, now, the first thing I think I want to ask you is, what is it about St. Louis that made you decide to leave Kansas City and take up residence on the other end of the state?
Well, I think a couple of reasons. One is, that was about 1971, so it was right after college. And when I looked at what was going on in St. Louis versus what was going on in Kansas City, I thought there was much more happening, not only politically but culturally in St. Louis. I had been going back and forth throughout college because there were a number of friends who were a part of the Black student organization at the college where I was, and we just would go back and forth, and I would see all of the things that were going on. And so that's really what the allure was, that I thought I could do much more with my newfound skills as well as my political enlightenment there in St. Louis. So that's what brought me here.
Now, when you first began attending college, was it your aspirations to become a political activist, or were you just going to college just solely for the purpose of getting an education?
Well, getting an education, because one of the things that I wanted to be was a teacher. And so, but I also knew that being in that kind of position, there was a lot of power and influence. And so, particularly at the high school level, because, you know, at that time you had like 35 to 40 kids in a class, and you had like five classes. So if you think that, I think about it, you had pretty much like at least 250 kids that you were influencing on a daily basis. So that resonated with me. And so that's the kind of teacher that I thought I wanted to be, is one that really was going to raise the consciousness of the young people that I had in the classroom, and also in the community. So I never saw it as like this separate silo that I would just be in the classroom, but I never saw myself being anything other than that. So when I went off to college, all that changed. It really did, because I was, you know, there's a lot of stuff happening in the late 60s. And so I came out with a newfound mission, and that's what I've been on ever since.
Was there ever a time in your life when there was a turning point that made you decide on becoming an activist as a career? Was there somebody that influenced your life, or did you have a person or an individual that inspired you to become what you are today?
I don't think it was so much one person. I think it was just being exposed to the times and being exposed to a number of thinkers, both those that had, you know, passed on before us as well as current ones. Now, keep in mind, I went off to school in the height of the Black Power movement. I graduated from high school in 1968. And so there was lots of stuff happening, particularly in St. Louis, I mean, in Kansas City. So all of those things were helping to shape the way that I was looking at the world. And what I thought my particular role was going to be going forward. So I think very early on, those kinds of seeds had already been planted, and people were just watering them as I moved along. So, for example, in high school, I was part of, you know, the junior chapter of the NAACP, and so, you know, that might have been a moderate organization, but it was still one of the foremost organizations that was fighting against injustice and racial discrimination. So it was not a leap to then go to college and be a part of the Black Student Organization to begin talking about Black history, Black studies, Black faculty, which there was none on our campus. So, you know, so those were the things I think that really helped move me along. So some of it was peers who had, they were coming from all over the country at the college that I was, Chicago, Philly, and so those folks had a different perspective based on where they live. And so you got a chance for the first time for me to really look at a more national approach to what was going on in this country at that time.
Now, I've been informed that you will be arriving here in town later today for a book signing and a discussion. Would you care to elaborate on this a little bit, please?
Yeah, I am. I am going to do that, and I will be hosted by the Black Archives of Mid-America. Been working with Glenn North, who's the executive director there, but also Justin Stein with Jobs for Justice, and people from the One Struggle thing, Kansas City, were helping to put that program together. So that will be tonight at the Black Archives of Mid-America. And the reception will be at 6 p.m., and the book signing and discussion will start at 6:30. So hopefully people know where the Black Archives is, because I think it's a place that everybody in Kansas City needs to know about and be supportive of. But just in case you don't, it's at 1722 East 17th Terrace, and that's right in the heart of the 18th and Vine Historic District. So so if you can come out tonight, 6 o'clock, you know, do a little networking with us, particularly if I haven't seen you in a while, come during that time so we can chat. And, you know, we'll start up at 6:30. So some people may have bought books already online. You can bring your book and I'll find it for you. But we hope to have a really good discussion going forward and really to find out how, you know, Ferguson is Kansas City. And if not now, it could be. So those are the kind of discussions I've been trying to generate as I move across the country with the book.
Okay, now, could you give our audience a little bit of insight about this book that you just recently had published?
So the Ferguson is America, Roots of Rebellion, really came about after the murder of Mike Brown by Darren Wilson in Ferguson, Missouri. And there were a number of questions about why Ferguson, because here was a police murder, yet we've had many police murders in that region, and particularly St. Louis, I mean, nonstop. So there was this question about what made Ferguson so unique. And so I really tried to answer that question. And some of those questions came from international media who were coming in to try to get like a scoop on 30 seconds worth of soundbite to answer that question, and it really couldn't be answered in 30 seconds. And so more importantly, some of the people who came into that space in the weeks and months after Mike Brown was killed were also wondering why. And so in many ways, I wrote it for the next generation of activists and organizers who need to understand that there's always a history, excuse me, to these kinds of incidents. They didn't just drop out of the sky. And so I really go back 40 years of organizing in North County and some of the conditions that African Americans faced as they went, were pushed north and west into these communities that were predominantly white. Because I think one of the things that really shocked people about Ferguson was that it was 70% population of African Americans, yet all of the decision-making bodies were predominantly white. So you had a white city council, you had a predominantly white police force, you had a white school board, and this scenario, almost like a apartheid scenario, seem to be foreign to people, but, you know, I have to remind people it's not that foreign. It's not so long ago that we remember what's happening, not only in the southern part of this country, where for years, based on, you know, white supremacy and segregation and racial discrimination, that there were many cities that were predominantly white that were ruled by a white minority. And so, so this was not some kind of anomaly. But certainly, people then could understand why there could be a rebellion there, given the kinds of things that we now know what was happening in Ferguson. So I just think that writing the book, in terms of my own perspective, my own organizing experiences, could help people to better understand the situation in the St. Louis region, but also why you can't always predict when there will be uprising and when people will have reached their boiling point. And so the conditions that I talk about are no different than in any other cities. And so that's why the title is Ferguson is America, because Ferguson could have been any city across this country, and it has been, truth be told. And even after Ferguson went up, we saw other cities, you know, reach their boiling point, Baltimore, you know, New York. And so it's not like it's a mystery, but sometimes people need those elements put in place all in one place so that they can better understand the historical context for that kind of uprising.
Now, we know what the immediate circumstances were which precipitated the Ferguson Rebellion. It was the killing of Michael Brown, like you said, and by the police officer Dan Wilson, and the reputation of Prosecutor Bob McCullen. What are some of the other circumstances which may have contributed to this rebellion?
Well, one thing we now know that many of us knew already, and that is the extreme exploitation of the municipal court system, which worked hand in hand with the police department in terms of racial profiling. So you had this incredible oppressive system where even the least kinds of infractions resulted in big fines, big court costs, and so many black families in Ferguson were victims of that, and in some cases even some of the surrounding areas, where a high percentage of municipal revenue was based on these kinds of fines and court costs. And so those definitely were a contributing factor. But you also had, you know, just housing and educational issues that contribute to that. And again, no different than any other cities where our school systems are failing, our young people are being expelled and suspended at disproportionate rates. You know, all of those things were contributing factors.
You are listening to 90.1 KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio. My name is Keith Brownhill. Today I'm speaking with Ms. Jamala Rogers, who is the author of the most recently released book entitled Ferguson is America, The Roots of Rebellion. She will be at a book signing and a discussion tonight at
The Black Archives of Mid-America.
The Black Archives of Mid-America, and the address is, what is it again?
It's 1722 East 17th Terrace, right down there in the 18th and Vine Historic District.
Okay. Now, I want to ask you, have there been any real changes in St. Louis since the uprising in Ferguson, Missouri?
Oh, of course, of course. I mean, some of them we haven't even been able to document because, you know, just because some of the changes have actually been in the hearts and minds of people. And so some of the things that were that have been changing, of course, is there were, you know, firings of certain people, including the police chief of Ferguson. Many wish that the mayor had stepped down because, you know, these are folks that were, that all this happened under their watch, and they could have done something differently and did not. So there's been personnel changes, of course, and there's also been some systemic changes in terms of the way that those court systems operate. And I don't think we're finished with that yet, because there's still a lot of discussion about how to consolidate some of those court systems so that people don't face multiple municipalities. Because one of the things that also interests people outside of the St. Louis area is that there's 91 municipalities in the St. Louis metropolitan area, and that's pretty unheard of. It doesn't exist anywhere in this country that we've been able to find out. Even here in Kansas City, I mean, you have like a suburban ring, but you don't have 91 of them.
Right.
So each one of those municipalities has its own government, its own set of laws, its own infrastructure. And so just because you got a ticket for a taillight in one municipality doesn't mean that's it. You can get it for five other ones, and that's how tight these municipalities are. You can go a five-mile stretch and hit six municipalities, and each one of them can give you a separate ticket. Looking at those systemic changes, we still continue to do that. There are a number of organizations that stayed in place after the shooting of Mike Brown to continue that work. And, you know, by and large, I think the ripple effect has been amazing as well, because I maintain that without Ferguson, you wouldn't have a concerned student 1950 at Mizzou. You wouldn't have a situation in Baltimore. So the ripple effect of what happened in Ferguson is real and can be seen. But we are still working on unearthing a lot of the injustices that existed, not just in Ferguson, but in that region. And so one of the things that happened, and we had been working on it for a number of years, long before Mike Brown was killed, and that is local control of the St. Louis Police Department, including the institution of the Civilian Oversight Board. So that board is now in place. It's gone through a training basically a grassroots effort, and we've been working on this for, as I said, for a number of years. And so it's now at the point that, you know, it's probably later on in April it will be ready to take on its first case. And so in many ways we're excited about that. But in other ways, we know what has happened to civilian oversight boards across the country. And many of them, because the community did not keep an eye on it or continue to make them accountable, fell either to the wayside or became ineffective because they basically were the step of approval by either the police department or the police chief or the mayor. So we have really worked hard to craft legislation that has citizen input in every step of the way. And so we're ready to launch that and see how that works. So there's been those kinds of examples, some big, some small, but definitely Ferguson shook the foundations throughout the St. Louis metropolitan area.
Now, I once read a quote by James Baldwin. He's in his book, Fire the Next Time, and he said that it's one thing to overthrow a tyrant and a dictator, and it's another thing to achieve a revolution. Now, do you think that the people who have been who replaced the chief of police and all the other officials who were fired in Ferguson, Missouri, did they simply go out and find somebody else that had the same frame of mind, or did they actually try to go out and find people who would do things differently, or have they had an opportunity to prove themselves yet?
Well, in some ways they haven't had an opportunity to prove themselves, but the police chief that was replaced had some issues, and so he had to be replaced. So there's been replacements of the replacements. But that's okay, because I think you have to do that in order to find what's the best fit. and who's going to carry out the duties as needed. And it's not, as we've been saying, this is not business as usual. And if it looks like that, smells like that, then we are going to be there to challenge that. So yeah, I think that some of those folks, there's been some change in the way that they perceive what is needed. But in many cases, they will claim that they can't find the appropriate folks. Because when you look at, for example, the police, and you look at the dwindling numbers of, say, African-Americans going into the police force, then in many ways you have to understand that that's going to have impact down the road on, you know, promotions, you know, who gets to be police chief. And so it's just been a very challenging thing to tell young people this is a profession that we need you to go in because we need black folks represented at all levels, including the police department. This is a powerful force, and if it's going to be one that serves our interests as opposed to an occupying force, then we have to have people who understand what the needs are in our community and who better than black folks. So that's always been a challenge to be able to replace people with folks who got a new understanding, a new vision of the kind of society that we're trying to create as opposed to one that's just replicating the status quo. So that's going to continue to be our challenge. But we're here for the long haul, and so we've got our eyes on that, those particular situations. And so we're going to maintain our steadfast vigilance about that.
Well, we're almost out of time, and I certainly do thank you for taking time out to give us this interview this morning. And I'm certainly going to make it my business to try to attend your book signing and your presentation this evening. And again, that presentation is at the Black Archives at 1722 East 17th Terrace. And the guest will be Ms. Jamala Rogers. She is the author of the book entitled Ferguson is America, The Roots of Rebellion. And we thank you very much for your time.
Okay, Keith, thanks for having me.
And I'm looking forward to seeing you tonight.
Okay, great.
Bye-bye.
All righty, take care now. Bye-bye.
Bye.
It's the 420 Drug War News.
It seems that every day more information is being put forward, is being recognized, and is being put in play in regards to the cannabis plant. Here to fill us in more is one of the directors of Patients Out of Time, who has some exciting news to share with us. And with that, I want to welcome Nurse Mary Lynn Mathry.
I think so. It's exciting to see, you know, more and more on the internet, people discovering things, passing information around, and trying to get rid of the stoner idea that it's only for people who want to get high. This is good medicine. The research supports that.
Just yesterday, was it the House or the Senate approved a medical marijuana bill in Pennsylvania? The governor has indicated he's ready to sign that bill.
And you know, the as the momentum grows, it's like that giant snowball, and it's getting to where it can't be stopped, which is good. But it means we all have to keep paying attention.
Well, indeed we do. And one way we can learn more and get a better focus is by attending a conference that is being...
Yeah, literally a month from today, folks, if people can make it. This is put on by Patients Out of Time, and we're actually celebrating our 21st year anniversary. We've been around since 1995, and we started our conference series in 2000. So coming up April 14th through 16th in Baltimore at the Baltimore Harbor Hotel, we'll be holding the 10th National Clinical Conference on Cannabis Therapeutics. And this year the theme is Cannabis, a Botanical Medicine. So we're going to be focusing on the whole plant as a medicine and describe why it works as a whole plant, the different formulations you can have, current research. Really, really excited about this conference. We've got one heck of a lineup. Got literally cannabis researchers coming from six different countries, counting the United States, but we've, you know, bringing in the big names and trying to really help Americans, and especially the healthcare professionals, understand that this is a very safe, very versatile, and essential medicine. And, of course, the other big thing on the news these days is the huge epidemic that we've got of opioid deaths, unintentional or intentional suicides, but many just overdoses, people either running out of their prescriptions and having to go on the illegal market for pain meds or heroin, or for whatever reason. And cannabis is a wonderful, safe alternative for many patients with chronic pain. The fact that, these legislators don't see this as a safe alternative to actually saving lives. For more information on this, please go to patientsoutoftime.org.
We hope you enjoyed today's show and that we leave you with something to think about, something to talk to your neighbors about, and a reason to get involved. As always, the opinions expressed are those of the host and guest of Jaws of Justice Radio, not of KKFI, the Midcoast Radio Project Incorporated, its staff, or volunteers. You can find our calendar of events and a link to our show episodes and podcast on the Jaws of Justice Radio Facebook page. If you have a show idea or want to help produce Jaws of Justice Radio, email us at jawsofjusticeradio@yahoo.com. And you can always listen to us live and find podcasts of our show on the KKFI website, that is kkfi.org. We thank our engineer, Beth Pike, for her work today. My name is Melvin Merritt, asking you to tune in for the rest of our 9 a.m. weekday lineup with Law and Disorder on Tuesday, Alternative Radio on Wednesday, Tell Somebody with Tom Claymer on Thursday, and Between the Lines at 9 a.m., followed by Bioneers at 9:30 a.m. on Fridays. Up next is Beautician Blues with Luscious Lynn, and at noon, Arts Magazine with Michael Ho. Stick around for jazz and blues in the afternoon and Eco Radio KC at 6 p.m. Then round out your day with the spicy Latin sounds of Sabor Latino and Fiesta Musical.